I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama began this week with a fiscal responsibility summit. He ends it with an exit plan for Iraq, a compromise that had set some of his core supporters. The president plans to pull out all combat troops from Iraq by August 2010, a 19-month timetable, 3 months longer than he promised during the campaign. Most of the drawdown is to begin next year, and it leaves 35 to 50,000 troops in Iraq as non-combatants. Julian Barnes is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Julian, if some of President Obama's backers are disappointed in this plan, what's been reaction from the military?
The military is pleased with this. I mean, it's a compromise. They originally wanted a 23-month drawdown, but they were pleased that the president essentially met them in the middle, coming off of his campaign promise and picking a date that they think takes some risk, but not unnecessary risk.
Well, John McCain, of course, who ran against Barack Obama, said today he supports the plan because it's significantly different from what Obama was saying during the campaign. Of course, that underscores what Obama supporters are unhappy with.
That's right. I mean, some people who did close readings of what Obama was saying in the campaign said, you know, this is not terribly different. He did always leave open the idea of a residual force for Iraq. He also said he would listen to his commanders when creating a responsible drawdown.
Well, what about the provision that will leave thousands of non-combat troops in Iraq? Democratic leaders of both houses, Harry Reid in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi in the House, seem unhappy with how high the number is.
Yeah, I mean, it is higher than Democrats thought. It is in the tens of thousands. The Obama administration is saying today is that, you know, this is a force that's only going to be there for the second half of 2010 and through 2011. After that, the agreement with Iraq says all forces must be out.
And tell us more about this status of forces agreement with Iraq that the U.S. negotiated last year. It, as you said, requires all U.S. troops to be pulled out of the country by the end of 2011. So does that mean non-combat troops?
That means, by the letter of that agreement, that all forces must be out. Now, there could be a few military to protect the embassy, but not tens of thousands. And the Obama administration is saying today that they're not looking for a Korea model or a Germany model. They do not want a long-term presence of tens of thousands of troops in Iraq. They are intending to meet that requirement of that agreement to get all forces out of Iraq.
And, of course, with other conflicts in mind, he's not saying this is the end of the war in Iraq, is he?
He is promising to wind down the war in Iraq. The end of the war in Iraq is not going to happen in August of 2010. There's still going to be forces there. They're going to be advising the Iraqis. They're going to be doing counterterrorism missions. We will still see Americans dying in Iraq after August 2010. But Obama is winding down the war. That is definitely true.
And how hard is that going to be? There are more than 200 military installations in Iraq, 142,000 troops, another 148,000 contractors. You know, how does this pullout work? Is it assumed that much of the equipment and certainly the bases themselves will be left behind?
That's a really good question. This is a huge logistics challenge for the military. Now, they have been planning for this. They knew this day would be coming. But there is, you know, tens of thousands of Humvees, MRAPs. There's thousands of tanks over there. All those things need to be removed. They're going to leave behind some of these bases, many of these bases, and they're going to transfer them to the Iraqis. But much of that equipment, especially the most sensitive equipment, they're not going to leave behind. They're going to have to take out.
Is this, in your view, at least in the short term, vindication for President Bush and General Petraeus' surge strategy?
You know, if the surge had not been militarily successful, Obama would not have as easy a time winding down the war. He would have much more resistance from the military at the pace of this drawdown. There would be much more danger that violence could flare up. So if it wasn't for the military success of the surge, this would have been very hard to do.
And, of course, historians will say if it weren't for the invasion of Iraq, we wouldn't be struggling to leave it.
The military always puts a caveat on that, leaving aside the initial invasion of Iraq. They realize that's a controversial decision and probably a decision that history is not going to look kindly upon.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, on Fridays, we like to kick back a little with a topic off the news radar. And on this Friday, we really need a break from the news. And we're not the only ones. President Obama plans to unwind at his first NBA game as president tonight. Who will he root for? The Washington Wizards take on Obama's hometown Chicago Bulls. It's well known, though, that Barack Obama loves basketball. He said he might replace the White House bowling alley with an indoor basketball court, all of which thrills hoop enthusiasts. But does it really matter? Well, according to the president's brother-in-law, Oregon State basketball coach Craig Robinson, basketball is why Barack Obama is in the White House. So today, a conversation about basketball and politics and race and the White House with Alex Wolf, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. His recent article is entitled The Audacity of Hoops, and he joins us now from the studios of Middlebury College in Vermont. Alex, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And also joining us is Claude Johnson. He started the blog Baller in Chief, and Claude also runs the website blackfives.com. It documents the history of African Americans in basketball prior to the integration of the NBA. And Claude joins us from the P&P studios in Stamford, Connecticut. Claude, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Hi, Robin.
And we want to talk to you both about just what basketball really does mean, if anything. And Alex, you start. What do you think of Obama's brother-in-law's statement? You know, he is where he is in the Oval Office because of basketball. Hyperbole?
Well, I do think what Craig Robinson was getting at there was this idea that while Barack Obama was going through his adolescence in Honolulu, he was in a state with very, very few African-Americans at the time. His dad was gone. He was trying to figure out who he was. And he's been very frank in his first book, his memoir, Dreams from My Father, about how basketball was a refuge. It was a place he could see other young blacks empowering themselves. And it set him off on this life's journey that I think has basketball weaving in and out of it.
Well, and his father, you know, in many ways abandoned him, but did, when he saw him that one time when he was 10, did give him a basketball.
Yeah, and the symbolism of that, I think Bryant Gumbel had a very revealing interview with Obama back during the campaign and asked him if that might have been part of the reason he's held so closely to the game all these years, that it was kind of a charge from his father. And he said, yeah, there's probably some truth to that.
Well, you know, Claude, who, again, you started this website, Baller in Chief, a baller, someone who plays pickup basketball. You did some research, and you say this is the first president to have such a strong interest in basketball. And I'm gathering that that's not the only thing that helped you identify with him. I mean, there's a lot that you also have in common. You are also mixed race. Your father's from the south side of Chicago. Your family lived out of the country for a while in Congo. You know, tell us more about, you know, Obama through that filter of basketball and mixed race for you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there's a strong ability to identify and to find yourself on the basketball court because it's colorblind. You become friends with folks that identify with you strictly based on your skills and your abilities. So when I was growing up, and I'm sure this was the case for Barack Obama, and he's pointed it out in his book, you have to make a choice sometimes of, am I black? Am I white? To white people, you're not white enough. To black people, you're not black enough. It can get very confusing. So I think for me, it's always been a place and a way of creating a world for myself where I could fit in and identify with the rest of the basketball
world. As a basketball player.
That's right.
Well, but Alex Wolf of Sports Illustrated, you take us through the whole trajectory of Obama, through the whole campaign where, you know, he played horse with a kid in Indiana, and then he sinks that three-pointer in Kuwait when he's visiting the troops. And it became at sometimes a politically slippery slope for Barack Obama, whether or not David Axelrod, you know, his campaign manager, wanted him to play basketball.
Yeah, and Axelrod confessed, I guess he could say this after the election safely, that he didn't want Obama to play back in early 07 up in New Hampshire, play basketball when he had invitations to, because he didn't want him to be introduced for the first time using that idiom, because it is somewhat racially charged. But then in New Hampshire, as we all know, over time, people get to know candidates very, very well. And then it was okay by Axelrod's lights to let him do that.
And I just want to underscore this because, you know, New Hampshire is a predominantly white state, and he was worried that if Obama played basketball, it would underscore that, oh, yes, he's black.
Well, just that if that were the first way that voters in New Hampshire, and I will point out New Hampshire is the last state to adopt the Martin Luther King holiday, not just a predominantly white state, but a predominantly white state that has a little work to do sometimes, that might have put him back on his heels a bit in terms of making that first impression.
Well, and would you say, though, and I think you do say in your article, that at least a couple other states, is it Indiana and North Carolina, he maybe won because he played basketball?
Well, the fact that he carried those states, I'm not saying basketball was the decisive factor. Obviously, if you're in Indiana, you see a lot of Obama on Illinois television. But here we have the two reddest states from the 2004 election. Indiana and North Carolina happen also to be two of the most basketball-obsessed states. And not only did Obama win them, but he did use basketball a lot to get out there, to connect with people. And I do think it maybe takes some of the foreignness and exotic nature of this candidate out of play.
Well, and Claude, you've said that both you and Obama use basketball as a way to fit in. But talk about basketball as a way to reach out. Is there something in the way Obama plays the game and maybe holds himself on the court that helps him maybe be a bridge maker off the court?
Yeah, I think so. Because in basketball, it's understood, especially in pickup basketball, that it's a team game. You are on a team, but the next game you might be on a completely different team with a completely different mix of ingredients on your squad. So it's about you, but not really about you. If you're playing on a fixed team, you can speak about your team's record, and you can say we're 19-1 or whatever your record is. But if you're playing pickup ball where every single game you might be on a different team, you still have to play team ball, but it's with different guys all the time. So you do have to involve everyone. You have to understand your role, and you have to understand that you can't just win only by your own skills or by your own self. And even if you did, then nobody might pick you up next time because you're a ball hog. So you want to distribute the ball. You want to play fair. There's a certain code of ethics, if you will, on the basketball court, especially in pickup, because there's no referee.
And yeah, there's an honor code. You have to call your own foul, and you honor the call.
That's right. There are several things that happen. I mean, everything from the way the teams get composed to the way you call your fouls and certain fouls that you do not call. No one will ever call an offensive foul. You definitely won't ever see things like a 3-second violation in the lane. Those are the technical rules that no one will ever call, because somebody would say, hey, what do you think this is, the NBA?
That's Claude Johnson. He writes the blog Baller in Chief. Again, a baller is someone who loves pickup basketball. We've also been speaking with Alex Wolf, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, about basketball in the White House. We're going to be back with both gentlemen. And later, back to the news. Obama's proposed tax changes has some charities nervous. Will wealthy people give less if they get less of a tax deduction? That's later. Plus, the snow alert guy speaks. We'll explain. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We've been talking about how basketball may or may not shape a presidency. We just heard how basketball may have won Barack Obama some votes, but also had the potential to lose him votes in parts of the country. And it might have won him a wife. Michelle Obama reportedly sent Obama into a pickup game with her brother, former college player, now college coach, Craig Robinson, before she'd seriously consider dating him. We've been talking with Claude Johnson. He started the blog Baller in Chief, a baller again being a pickup player. And we're also talking to Alex Wolf, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, whose recent article is entitled The Audacity of Hoops and tried to get to the bottom of whether or not a man's play has anything to do with his presidency. And Alex, you talked to a lot of people who compare Barack Obama to different players. Claude was quoted as saying he saw the elegance and even temper of the San Antonio Spurs guard Tony Parker in Barack Obama. Others say they see a little Kenny Anderson, a little Delonte West, as you write, without the neck tattoos. But Obama's brother-in-law comes up with Lenny Wilkins. This is the Hall of Famer. What did that mean to you?
I think it's the old school part of the equation, that he learned the game on the streets, he had a fine collegiate career, a good pro career, and then he became a player coach and went into the Hall of Fame, and really a community organizer. I mean, let's get right down to what it is. That's what Lenny Wilkins, a player coach, is that, really, and a really good pickup player, somebody who kind of commands the court and can bring order to the chaos and will find ways to bring people together and resolve conflicts. Plus, Lenny Wilkins is left-handed. Plus, he has a kind of upright carriage. Now, I know Claude has his own case to be made for Tony Parker, and Tony Parker has a very clever ball-handling game. And the little clips on YouTube you can see of the president playing ball, he has a lovely way of dribbling low and getting free or getting a quick step into the lane to get to the basket.
Well, and he never loses his cool, as you know, as everyone has said. But this is getting awfully fawning. So I'm trying to see a way where we might, you know, make this a more complicated story, you know, add a little more Shakespearean character to Barack Obama as a basketball player. And I see it when in his playing at Punahou, his high school, where his coach, you know, didn't think that he was as good as maybe Barack Obama thought he was. And Barack Obama, it sounds like, Alex, you're writing, Barack Obama didn't take that. In fact, led a contingent of players to campaign for more playing time. Was this a time in his life where maybe Barack Obama maybe needed to be taken down a peg or two and understand what it was like to be on a team?
Well, he was the headstrong guy who had a street game. He'd really been self-taught. He hung out on the playgrounds. He liked to spin into the lane and do fallaways. He was a very individualistic player playing for a coach who believed in structure, who was getting great results doing it his way. So there really was no place for the young Barry Obama in that team other than as a practice player. And to be fair to him, he led that contingent into the coach's office in part on behalf of those teammates whom he was very close to, the end of the bench crew. Mm. But he has admitted that his coach in high school, Coach Mack, was right, that he wasn't quite as good as he believed in his own mind to be. And to watch his style morph into this, you know, little flashes of his old street pedigree, but pretty buttoned-up style of game here in his late 40s, is to see that maybe he believed what Coach Mack had said way back then at Punahou.
Well, and there's a lovely moment you detail where I think on a campaign in 2004, he's then senator from Illinois. He goes back to his school, and there's his old coach, Coach Mack, in the stands, and he's able to say to him, "You were right." And that coach said he felt a weight fall away from his shoulders because he thought, well, maybe I've damaged this guy by not playing him in high school.
Well, imagine if you or I had coached the future president of the United States in high school.
And not played him.
And not played him and wonder, what did I miss in this guy's leadership qualities, whatever it might be. But if you really want to stick the needle into the new president, I think the grounds on which to do it is what he wears when he plays. He wears these goofy sweatpants and usually a gray T-shirt. And there is a Chicago sports columnist who's theorized that he's very self-conscious about his skinny legs and doesn't want anybody to see them.
I think it's because he's got tattoos, Alex.
Well, you know what, Claude, I want to ask you. Alex did just say something, though, about how there's an uptight, almost white, I think you said, Alex, calm way to the president. Every now and then you see some street. And what do you think that does for African-Americans in particular, basketball players in very particular, who watch Barack Obama when they see glimpses of something else from him on the court?
Well, see, now you've nailed it, right? Because when we were growing up, and I'm roughly about a year older than Barack Obama. But when we were growing up, it was always Boston Celtics or Los Angeles Lakers.
Yeah.
So you had to decide, am I going to be more Celtics, which is Larry Bird, which is Kevin McHale, mm-hmm. and sort of, let's call it white, in
mm-hmm.
quotes.
Yes.
Or am I going to be Showtime Lakers, the black thing? And I think that when you go into politics, I mean, obviously mainstream, there's a reason why Barack Obama succeeded, because he had to play both of those. He had to show glimpses of Lakers, but he also had to show, look, I get the fundamentals. I understand the groundwork and the practice and the technical aspects and the science of the game. And I think that when voters began to see that he had some basketball skills, they all of a sudden saw that, okay, we weren't sure we could trust this brother, right? We weren't sure. Now all of a sudden, well, he's got some basketball skills, so he must be down.
Well, Claude, I just want to let you have the last thought. You go so far as to say that you feel that Barack Obama playing basketball is a matter of national security. Because?
Yes. Well, I think that, look, the president has to remain clear in his thinking, and he has to be calm and cool and collected. And he said that what does that for him is basketball. So if I get called to the White House on an invitation to play basketball, then my ability to play, therefore, is a matter of national security. Because if I show up and I can't play, and that means he can't play his full game, then that could potentially impact the country and the rest of the world and change our
life as we know it.
Life as we know it, yeah.
That's Claude Johnson. He started the blog Baller in Chief, but also runs the website blackfives.com. It documents the history of African Americans in basketball prior to the integration of the NBA. And we've also been speaking to Alex Wolf of Sports Illustrated. His recent article is entitled The Audacity of Hoops. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both.
Thank you,
Rob. Thank you very much.
Okay, looking ahead, next week on Here and Now, over 300 ransom kidnappings took place in Phoenix, Arizona last year. Why don't more Americans know about that? That's next week. Still ahead today, Doris Kearns Goodwin on FDR the Student, Here and Now. It's hard to describe bad economic headlines when there have been so many, but today the country's gauge of its economic engine, the GDP, had its biggest drop in 25 years. Translation, the amount of things Americans produced dropped by $187 billion from the third to the fourth quarter last year. And on Wall Street, that news sent the S&P 500 below what analysts had previously said was the bottom. And in this climate, nonprofits, homeless shelters, arts organizations, public radio are all trying to figure out the impact of President Obama's new budget. Under his proposal, wealthier Americans could get less of a tax break on the money they donate to charities. Here's what CNBC's Maria Bartiromo thought of that.
There are such unintended consequences in this. First of all, charitable contributions, get ready for those to go off a cliff, because you are not going to get the tax write-off that you got in terms of, you know, charitable contributions.
Is that true? Some research shows tax breaks aren't the reason wealthy people make donations. Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And Stacey, first of all, can you explain how the president's proposed change in tax deductions will work? We know that wealthier people are in the 33% to 35% tax bracket. So, you know, take a donation and explain that.
Right. So if you're giving $100,000, for example, you get to write off $35,000. So it doesn't cost so much when you're making a charitable gift, and people give more as a result. And so if you limit it to something like 28%, then they get to write off $28,000. So that's, you know, $7,000 or so that they won't be able to write off on their taxes. So it's not eliminating the tax break. It's just meaning that they get less.
Well, and your journalist interviewed a lot of people. What were they saying?
There's a mixed reaction as to what kind of effect this will be, and in part it depends on what kinds of charities you're talking about. Colleges, hospitals, museums, those kinds of organizations that raise a lot of money from wealthy people, they may be affected a lot more than soup kitchens, homeless shelters, domestic violence shelters, those kinds of places that raise money largely from lots of people who don't have a lot of money and don't really worry about taxes in their giving, and so I don't think they'll be very affected by it. So different parts of the nonprofit world are affected in dramatically different ways.
Well, and one person you quoted, Robert Sharp, who's a fundraising expert in Memphis, told the New York Times that many of the wealthiest donors are already limited to deductions of 28% because of the alternative minimum tax. Explain that.
Yes, indeed. There's a lot of complicated taxes that go on when you're deducting charitable giving, and basically people want to be sure that everyone is taking the right kinds of tax deductions and so that people don't overly deduct. And so that limitation means that some people already are facing this limit, and so they've always faced that 28% tax break. So this isn't even a change. So it's more the idea that the charitable deduction is being changed and maybe not valued so much than the practical effect.
Well, except that we hear from other researchers in this arena who say that tax deductions are way down on the list of the reasons that the very wealthy give to organizations. They genuinely love organizations and want to invest in them.
It's true to a certain extent that the amount that people give usually is affected by the tax versus the decision to give. People decide to give because they love the organization, but if they know that they're going to get a good tax break and save some money, especially if they're affluent but not incredibly rich, and a lot of people are feeling just affluent, not very rich these days as they saw their stock portfolios go down and they're worried about losing their jobs. So those kinds of people may decide, I'm just not going to give as much. It's not worth it. And at a time when charities really are seeing a dramatic increase in demand for all kinds of services, this isn't a great time to send that message.
You quoted a Chicago lawyer who said charities are facing a triple whammy: the recession, this proposed tax deduction limit, and also increased taxes for the wealthy under the same plan announced by Barack Obama. On the other hand, if these are philanthropic people, will they make the equation that the tax break they're not getting, that $7,000 on $100,000, is going to go into health care for people who really need it?
I think many people will understand the goals, and some people may change their habits, but I don't think we're going to see charitable giving go down in a big way because wealthy people do understand that it's their responsibility to give.
Stacey Palmer with a very charitable view of philanthropists. She's editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a couple of minutes now for some of your thoughts. And we heard from many of you after our visit with Daisy Myers, whose family was the first black family to move into Levittown, Pennsylvania in 1957, sparking race riots there. It's one of the recommended stories on our website. Louise Voorhees of Schnecksville, Pennsylvania writes, I attended first grade with the oldest Myers boy, but was unaware of the ugly behavior taking place at the time. Thank you for shining a light on this important history, which happened literally in my backyard. Well, remember yesterday's piece on the music mix of the Somerville, Massachusetts Communication Director Tom Champion's Snow Alert.
This is Tom Champion calling from the city of Somerville. Based on current weather conditions, the city will be declaring a snow emergency effective at 12 midnight tonight. During snow emergencies, cars not moving from the even-numbered side of the street may be subject to ticketing and towing.
Tom's on the line, and Tom, you wanted us to know that these are not robocalls, as I said, to residents. This is a high technology that enables you to do what?
Well, this is a different technology than the old reverse 911 system, which could take hours to call a city the size of Somerville. This is what's called a mass notification system, and it allows us to call the whole city, about 30,000 phone numbers and emails, in 10 to 15 minutes.
And as you know, a lot of people found it amusing that Somerville has this odd side of the street parking requirement during snow alerts so that the plows can clear the even side. But we know that in other towns, they don't give you any notice and your cars are towed. And in neighboring Medford, they switch on a yearly basis. One year they park on the odd side, one year they park on the even side. And you've heard from some people in Medford.
That's right. There is a group in Medford near the Somerville line who have written to the mayor in the past suggesting that they want to actually secede from Medford and join Somerville because we do such a good job of getting the word out on our snow emergencies and because actually they think we do a better job of getting snow and ice off the streets.
And Tom, we have to ask, we understand your alert became so popular it inspired a Facebook page.
First, I found out there was a Facebook group called This is Tom Champion from the City of Somerville. Then there was a lot of commentary, and on the local Somerville Journal website, they had a haiku smackdown where people contributed haikus about the phenomenon of emergency calls.
Come on, Tom. Isn't the fact that you are Tom Champion, deliverer of the snow alerts?
There's no question that my name plays a big role in this. There are still people out there to this day who claim that I am, in fact, a fictional person.
Because snow is expected to begin before sunrise, residents should plan to move their cars before they go to bed. For additional information, please call the city's 311 constituent service line. Thank you.
Hello.
And finally, after we reported on the death of 12-year-old Hunter Pope, the fourth child in the U.S. this year to succumb to the flu, Dr. Rose French, executive director of the International Horn Society, wrote to say, I work closely with Hunter's father, Ken. He owns a horn restoration shop and performs regularly with the Boston Symphony. I once held a fundraiser to purchase an instrument for a deserving student here in Phoenix, Arizona, and Ken donated two instruments. Now two students in the Phoenix area have great instruments from a very selfless individual. I told my students this week about his son, and one who received the donated instrument said, "I will name my instrument Hunter after Ken's son." To 1904, before he was a man of the people, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a privileged Harvard student. He lived in splendor here at what's now Harvard's Adams House. The only mention of that, a bronze plaque. Well, now the newly formed FDR Foundation wants to change that. They want to restore the FDR rooms to their original glory. To the joy of historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, as you'll hear, Michael Wishon is president of the FDR Suite Foundation, a Harvard alum and former host of PBS's The Victory Garden. We met him outside what was the upscale Westmoreley Court when FDR lived there.
Well, it's a brick and stonework, all carved limestone. Originally, there was a fountain here and the door bubbling away. The clock, which is now chiming, that's St. Paul's next door. There's a clock built into the walls, these huge bay windows and ironwork. It's exactly what you would expect of a high-end Victorian apartment. These were palatial accommodations for Harvard students at the time, complete with pool and fountain and marvelous ornate brickwork. It's pretty spectacular. Going through the portal.
And we're going down a hall. Well, you described this woodwork.
This is traditional heavy walnut paneling on this marble tile floor.
Okay, so here we are at number...
This was, in FDR's time, B27.
Here we go. And now here's the plaque. The first thing we see on coming in, it says Franklin Delano Roosevelt lived in this room, 1900-1904. A student in Harvard University.
As you see, in this very high luxury, we're standing in this room. It has 14-foot ceilings, working fireplace, large French doors with a small balcony, two bedrooms, fairly ample, again with 14-foot ceilings, central heating, which was a huge luxury at the time. This was one of the few buildings on campus that had central heat.
It's been so closed off, you feel like you're breathing the air that he breathed.
Well, the plan for the restoration is to really restore it back. You're going to walk in this door, and it's going to look as if it looked in 1903.
I've seen the sketch. It's quite ornate what it's going to look like.
Unlike an interior that you would expect in any house today, I mean, every wall is covered with pictures, every surface with knickknacks. The palette is very bright. The current room is pale floors and white walls. Originally, this would have been vermilion damask. The floors would have been covered with rugs, not just one, but rugs upon rugs, runners on top of oriental carpets, sculptures, bronzes, you know, gaslight. This was still lit with gas and electricity in those days, double fixtures so that you could light either one because the electricity wasn't reliable.
Can we go see the bathroom? We're hearing the hissing. But
yeah, that's Harvard's famous steam radiator system. Here we are at the presidential seat, as it were, complete with flush toilet. It actually still has its upright tank, and the chain it pulls, and down it goes.
This was here?
Yes, this is the original bathroom. It never got renovated, unlike all the other student rooms, so it still has all these original fixtures. It still has its original finishes. A little worse for wear, but, you know, 100 years later, it's not doing too badly.
So this is the sink. It's like a marble top sink with two... what are those, copper...
spigots, yeah.
Copper spigots. This is the sink where he stood?
Yep, this is the sink where he stood and shaved. And behind me is the clawfoot tub. He would have sat and bathed in this tub. And in those days, showers were not a very common thing. So you had a sort of a French handle system and you sat and took your daily bath.
Okay, let's move on to the larger area. Why is this project so important to you?
Because it's FDR. I mean, think about it. How many times do you actually get to walk into a room and spend time unsupervised in a place that has presidential associations? I mean, normally you're walking through with a park ranger or...
velvet ropes.
Velvet ropes, and everything is going to be, you know, tied off or cordoned off. this will actually be accommodations. The guests of the university, FDR scholars, people can come and will stay here in the same bedroom that FDR slept in. I mean, I don't think there's anywhere in the world that you can do that.
Well, she's not listening. What was Doris Kearns Goodwin like when she first came in here?
She was like, my God, this is amazing. Here we are in the footsteps. The same feeling I have. It's like, you know, here we are. He was sitting in his chair studying the things that made him the man that he eventually turned out to be.
Michael Wishon, president of the FDR Sweet Foundation. To see pictures of their plan, go to our website, here-now.org. And when we come back, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin on standing where FDR stood, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. We all know FDR's most famous saying from his 1933 inaugural, "The only thing we have to fear, fear itself." And what was that fear?
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
But as acclaimed as that speech was, Roosevelt's fellow Harvard alums hated his New Deal proposals, and as a student, he was a lot like them. He lived in an elaborately furnished suite of rooms at Westmoreland Court, now Adams House. But after a plaque was put on the wall, it was used for office space, never renovated. In fact, few people knew it was there, including Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, who went to grad school and taught at Harvard in the late 60s. The FDR Sweet Foundation has now enrolled Doris in their quest to restore FDR's rooms at Harvard. When she arrived in the slightly worn suite, which she's just recently seen, we asked, who was FDR when he lived there?
Well, first of all, he was tall and thin, somewhat effete. He had come from Groton, a boys' school, a special private school, an aristocratic background that he brought with him to Harvard. So that the person that we knew later, one who understood people who had also been dealt bad hands in life, had had a much more privileged life up until that point.
So how was he viewed by his Harvard classmates?
Well, first of all, there still was that charming side of his personality. So the people who got to know him could see that warmth, that good fellowship. But there were sadnesses here for him at Harvard. He did not get into the Porcellian Club, the very, very fancy club that everybody wanted to get into. And much later in his life said that it was one of the sadnesses that he never got over, which is nuts. I mean, he's president of the United States, leader of the allied worlds. You still remember. But I guess when you're an adolescent, those things burn deeply.
And the Porcellian Club was what?
Porcellian Club was one of those clubs that you had to have a certain pedigree to get into, but you also had to be chosen by its members with these elaborate ceremonies. I mean, they would give you certain knocks on the door, you'd be out on the street and they would call your name. And he got into other clubs that were almost equally prestigious, the Fly Club. He was the captain of the freshman football team, so he was very active in his typical way, but that was the one hurtful thing.
Is this a painting that we're looking at right now? Is that what he would have looked like?
Yes. See the hair in this painting that we're looking at now with the parting in the middle coming down on either side. I mean, a very good-looking man still, but without somehow that sense of stature that he had developed later in his life. When I see the pictures of him now versus the pictures of him when he's president, it seems to me a very different man. And I think the reason for that is that Eleanor Roosevelt said that after polio, in some ways it transformed him, that it made him more serious, more focused, more concentrated, much more able to be sensitive to other people's needs. He'd always cared about people, as she said, but now people were his main lifeline to life. So he became a much more open person after that.
What kind of student was he here at Harvard?
Well, they called him a Gentleman C student, which was actually not a bad student. I gather in today's world it might be a high B student. But when you came from that background that you did, you weren't supposed to be a grind. I mean, interestingly, when Teddy Roosevelt was here before FDR, and he would say that he was actually second among the people from his class, which meant he was like 21st in the class, but all the people before him came from non-aristocratic backgrounds.
So he counted the number he liked.
Exactly. He counted the people that were his people. And in that group, there was only one ahead of him. So in that sense, I mean, you were meant to enjoy your subjects. And the great thing about FDR is that even though it wasn't that he became a great student, an intellectual savant, whatever he read, Eleanor later said, he remembered. He could pick up a book and say, oh, yes, I read that in college, turn to the page, and then recite what was on that page. So he evidently had a terrific memory. It is said that when he took a philosophy course, he didn't like that at all, which makes complete sense, since he was a man who liked to think practical terms. What can I do? Explain things to the people in the most simple language. He wouldn't like all that highfalutin kind of language.
I love how you somehow, I mean, through the research that you do, these people come alive for you. And, you know, I can hear now you're speaking as if you knew FDR in college in 1900. What is it in here that helps you feel this man you've researched?
I think there's something magic whenever you step foot in a place where the person that you're researching actually lived and walked. When I was 7 years old, my parents took me to Hyde Park, and I remember seeing the desk of FDR's, and he had his glasses on it and his cigarette holder. And I turned to my parents and said, he can't be dead. He's left his glasses here. He has to come back and get them. And that's the wonderful thing I think about recreating this room. It means that both students at Harvard and people coming to visit this room will see that aspect of FDR's life. And incredibly, Harvard has done so little to memorialize FDR's memory. Teddy Roosevelt has a whole library where all of his papers are housed. There's a plaque for Teddy Roosevelt. JFK has the School of Public Affairs named after him, plus the suite where he lived. And FDR, perhaps the greatest of these presidents, this is the first time that he's really, except for a plaque that said that this was his room, it's about time for FDR.
Well, we should say, you know, it's a little, actually, worn. You know, it's a little run down, you know. I mean, it is surprising that there hadn't been more attention paid to these rooms.
It really is, because, you know, when you think about what even the other Harvard students who've gone there, legions of them since FDR, if this room had been set aside even after he died, for example, and been kept at that point in the fashion that you would hope it to, you would hope that some other student might have come in here and thought, my God, this is the man who led the Allied forces to victory in World War II. This is the man who took us through the Depression. But maybe now is the right time for this. I mean, FDR is back in people's minds so much, given the recession that we're going through now and so many remembrances of that great confident leadership that he gave us from his first inaugural. At the time of the anniversary of World War II, it seemed that finally he had come around to being respected by Republicans and Democrats alike. I mean, that was part of his heritage here at Harvard as well, because when he came back for the big anniversary, the 300th anniversary in 1936, he was considered by many in his class a traitor to his class because of all of his New Deal regulations. So there was a sense in which there was a lot of disrespect shown for him at that time. But even then, that optimistic, gregarious nature still loved Harvard despite the fact that it had hurt him several times along the way.
Well, you know, Doris Kearns Goodwin, since you bring this up, I do want to ask you, we ping-pong back and forth between analysts on the program who say it's all the spending during the New Deal that helped the U.S. pull out of that depression, and others, including Harvard's Neil Ferguson, who say, no, this is a different time, and by the way, it wasn't the spending during the New Deal that helped. It was World War II that actually pulled us out of the depression. Where do you come down? What did happen in your mind?
Even though it's true the Depression didn't fully come to an end until World War II started, people who lived during the 1930s were enormously helped by his programs. They got through that decade as a result, whether it was the Work Progress Administration or the Federal Theater Project and jobs that were provided. So you live in the short term. You know, I remember when I was teaching here, and it was a time of a lot of radical liberalism, and some student put up her hand and she said, but it didn't end the Depression. And I said, but people live in the short term. They don't live in the long term. I remember that argument even back then.
Meaning that, you know, it helped them in 1936, even if it didn't end the Depression till years later.
Absolutely. And if we had fallen apart during the 30s, if we had moved toward communism or fascism, and meanwhile then you had Hitler in Europe, what would we have been in terms of being ready to fight World War II? So even if you just kept people going during that period and didn't bring back the full private flowering of industry, but yet they were still alive, still enthusiastic, still energetic, ready to be mobilized for war and to fight that huge war, that's a huge accomplishment.
Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin speaking about FDR and the FDR Suite Foundation's efforts to restore his rooms at Harvard University. By the way, this song from a 1930s musical was his campaign song, Talk About Optimism. To see a picture of the plan for the FDR rooms, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hathi, and Jill Ryan. Doug Sugertz is our technical director. Jim
Jim Kiesling helped out today. Thanks, Jim. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns, Jesse Martin and Hillary Niles. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen. You guys are giving me Agita McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.